Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
And you're very welcome back now. And actually, Pat in Limerick is on to us saying, I remember seeing Courtney Pavlov performing in the circus, an amazing young lady. So people have seen her around the place. And there are circus big tops. It is the season where it's coming right into it. Now, 51551 on the text. We're going to somewhere completely different now because Brian Penny is presenting a three-part documentary. It looks really good. I've seen the trailer. It starts on RT1 television tomorrow night after the 9 o'clock news. It's called Hooked, and it is looking at all kinds of addictions, from gaming to gambling, alcohol, drugs, and even smartphones, although smartphones associated with nearly everything there. Brian himself, he started his own recovery from addiction, drug addiction it was, back in 2013, after which he pursued and received a PhD in neuroscience. So that is quite a recovery. And he joins us this morning. His sister Anne is here as well, because we're going to talk about how addiction hits the whole family. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
But first of all, Brian, good to... Well, I'm seeing you for the first time, but we met over the phone about 5 years ago when you were promoting your book,
yeah.
Bonus Time, is
yeah.
that what it's called. How are you doing? How have you been?
I'm doing great, God. It brings me back to the book, Bonus Time. I named it that. I was given a second chance at life and recovery, living on Bonus Time. And
my God,
Bonus
you've
time
used
is going great.
You have a PhD in neuroscience, so I'll try to follow the conversation as best I can. The first thing you do in episode one is give us more or less a crash course in your history and addiction. So can you do that with us briefly this morning, if it's not too rude?
Yeah, no, not at all. I think one thing I try to get across to people is, like, I was addicted to heroin for 15 years, other drugs for more. But I didn't really have a drug problem per se. I had an anxiety, a panic attack problem from trauma, and I was really medicating and self-soothing. So I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. The essence of addiction is really avoiding and escaping pain.
Right.
So really that's the journey I had. I used drugs to self-soothe. I used drugs to escape how I felt. And I was just in a different realm of reality for so long, trapped in that world. Functional addict for a lot of that time as well, but just really trapped in that world until I luckily found an escape.
The path out. You wrote and you've talked about the fact that how you were frightened of your own body, right down to your heartbeat and your breath. Can you break down that level of fear that you would have?
Yeah, so it's quite shocking, actually. So I had an operation as an infant. I was only a couple of weeks old. But before 1985, this is quite shocking for people, that infants did not get a general anaesthetic when undergoing surgery. So I was awake undergoing surgery, like invasive surgery, where they were going in and sort of messing around with my intestines to put them back in place. So obviously I don't remember that. But what we know today is that the body keeps the score. It's the name of a great book. And even I'm 46 years of age today, and I still have the urge to...
Today, not today, this year.
And I still have the urge to rub the scar, like, even with that. And trauma just leaves a mark on the body. Like, it changes your biology to how you respond to future threats and danger. And that's where the need to self-soothe was. And I grew up with a phobic fear of my heartbeat, my breath, my pulse. I was just so afraid of my own inner world, always anxious, always agitated, hence the need to escape that reality.
At the height of your addiction, somehow you managed to get a job and hold it down, hold it together, longer than you might expect.
Yeah, it's crazy. Ironically, I worked for Big Pharma, funnily enough, designing methadone and anti-anxiety medication. That's a very ironic part of the journey. But I was good at my job when I was awake, in inverted commas, like, which is a crazy thing to say. But I was sort of technical. I suppose I was always, I wouldn't say academic, but I applied myself to things and I was good at my job. But an awful lot of enabling went on in the workplace. Like, I got on great, had some great friends in the workplace, and they really protected me. So when I looked really stoned or when I was really unwell, they sort of hid that in a way to protect me, because they were trying to look after me. And that enabling can have a big role in the workplace and in family dynamics as well.
That's extraordinary, Anne. Yeah. It's hard to believe. Anne is here. You're the baby girl of the Penny household.
I am. Three older brothers.
Do you remember, how do you view Brian through, well, how did you view Brian first of all before his troubles? What was the dynamic like between yourself?
We were great pals, like, we're all great pals growing up, and there's 8-9 years between us, and then 12 years between my eldest brother, so, like, there was a big age gap where those kind of Brian and Kelvin were raised, you know, and then me and James were kind of raised separately, not separately, but, like, it was just a different dynamic at different times. So yeah, really felt like really felt like that, like the big brother, the older brother, and like really looked up to himself and his friends, and Westlife were big at the time, so they were kind of emulating that as well, like that age. So yeah, we really really looked up to him, like, yeah, definitely.
And he was smart, you could tell.
Yeah, always kind of had smarts about him, like in different ways. So yeah, like definitely had smarts about him, all right.
When did your relationship then with Brian begin to change?
Things changed, I'd say, around my teenage years. So like my own kind of, I would have been out with my own friends and drinking with my own pals. But like, you know, Brian would have always looked out for me. But then we started around my teenage years. I kind of started to see that there was something else going on, and right, that he wasn't around as much, or he wasn't picking up on things as much, or, you know, so we didn't have the same relationship, you know, that was kind of starting to separate.
He's sort of stopping your big brother, the shoulder to lean on, I suppose. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I would have really felt like that he would have been one of a person I could go to with any issues, but I didn't have that kind of that connection was gone at that point.
And home was Blanchardstown, was it, up around?
Yeah,
strong community there. You'd be used to kind of leaning on each other, particularly within family.
Definitely. It was a great little community when we got there, because there was a lot of families put into an area, and it was in the middle of nowhere at the time. So there was a great community spirit, and everyone looked after each other, and especially with the family dynamics and our extended family as well. We all really looked out for each other.
Yeah, our extended family is amazing. Like, especially my mum's side of the family, they've been so helpful to us over the years.
Yeah. Brian, when you were addicted to heroin, smoking heroin is what you're doing. And you would have seen Anne, you would have witnessed him on the nod, is the phrase they use, isn't it?
Goofing off.
Yeah. Goofing off. Yeah. What does that look like to anyone who hasn't seen it?
It's quite subdued, like it's quite relaxed. It's not like a manic drug, like it doesn't make you kind of excited, but it's hard to watch in the sense that, you know, he'd be tiggling his face a lot and then just kind of like goofing off at the table, but very much believing that he's okay. And then like we'd wake him up and he'd be kind of snap back into him and be like, oh no, I'm all right. Like, but, so it was quite hard to watch. And that was very much near the end that was becoming more like out in within the family. Like,
so
you know,
it used to
be something that was happening like up in the bedroom, but it was becoming that it happened at the kitchen table now.
Would you be able to discuss it as a family at all, or was it something that was just taboo?
Yeah, it was hard because it was kind of not really fully understood or really known what was going on. Like everybody kind of had an inkling, but it wasn't like out on the table that we were able to discuss it as a family. And it was quite difficult. Like, it was quite difficult, you know, for my parents and for my brothers and for myself to probably even accept that that's the reality. This is what's going on. Like,
Brian, you said in a previous interview that Anne kind of bore the brunt of your addiction in the family dynamic.
Yeah, my mum and Anne definitely did. And I think they were trying to help me so much. But I think like a really key part of it is like when someone's in addiction, they're in a different world. Like, you tell yourself this web of lies, this self-deception to keep the addiction alive. So I think one of the reasons why it was so hard to talk for people to challenge me is that I was always pretending that I was getting better, that I was trying to get off the drugs. And I'd even convinced myself. So I suppose Anne and me mum sort of recognised that this wasn't really happening, and me dad and me brothers probably fell for it more. But like, even when they tried to distance themselves from me because I was just causing so much pain, I was always trying to prove that I was getting better. And there was a few crazy experiences where I tried to prove myself, but it was ridiculous, like a really bad attempt. Like,
happily, you do seek a treatment for your addiction, and you went to recovery. It's a long process, probably easy to talk about it now. But huge relief for the family, Anne, though, when it begins.
Yeah, it was huge relief. Like, we worked at trying to get him, when you kind of realise, like, I need to get help. I just need to can't live like this anymore. It was a huge relief to be able to nearly hand him over to somebody else. Like, you know, we weren't worried about him driving the car. We weren't worried about where he was or who he was meeting. So it was quite a relief to hand him over. Like, even though there was a lot of work still to be done and a lot of family work and a lot of up and travelling up and down from, you know, getting you into the Lantern and then getting you down to Ashery and Wexford, then to, you know, kind of seeing him. There's still a lot of work to do, but it was, it was a relief. Like, even when he was coming out then, that was a big shock, where I just didn't want him back. It was like the relief of the 4 weeks of him being away was so nice that when he was coming out, it was very anxiety provoking.
Yes, there'd be terrible worry, wasn't it?
It was a huge worry, yeah.
In the documentary, you refer to a letter Brian writes to you from the station. Can you tell us about that?
So, I was, kind of setting up my life with my kids. Well, I hadn't had kids. I was thinking about having kids. I was with my now husband. We were in an apartment and I was trying to kind of get my life together. Like I was in a dream job and, so everything was going really well. And, we got him into the Lantern and he was in Escherie. So I felt like I was like, right, I'm on the right track here. And Brian decides then to send letters home explaining that he knows how to fix my life and how to help me and what I'm doing wrong. And, so there was a lot of anger. I wrote my own letter in reply. I never sent it. But as a therapeutic process, I wrote that out.
Very good.
Never probably should have gave it to you. But it was like, we can laugh about it now, but God, at the time it was like infuriating is mildly to put it, but it was.
What did you do with the letter?
Oh, I just ripped it up and was like, is he? It's as many words as you want to put in there.
You understand the context now, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I could even appreciate even at the time, because I was after doing a lot of my own work myself and I've been continuously doing work for a long time. But it was just the angle it was coming from. And the idea as well. And he was kind of like unaware of the work that went into getting him to the Lantern, getting him into Escherie. Like I was working 6 days, 1 week, 4 days the next, and then every Wednesday driving down to Escherie, weekends, then family days on a Sunday. So it was quite intense, time. But we were still living. So people in addiction, unfortunately, just feel like everything kind of revolves around them.
Yes.
And that kind of life is on pause and everybody's just kind of waiting for their next move, whereas we're all still having these lives to live and do this as well, so that was.
Were you working in Dublin Zoo around that time?
I was, I was in Dublin Zoo at the time. Okay. It was fab.
So just to give in a context of stuff
the
going on in your
job,
life.
Training baby elephants.
Training the baby elephants, it was gorgeous.
Sounds like a very therapeutic place to be.
It was, absolutely, it really was.
The documentary is about this, the impact it has on family. And obviously when the group therapy begins as part of recovery, the family have to come in, don't they? What was that like for you, Brian?
It was funny. See, I had a shift in perspective when I was in detox. Like I had a near-death experience. I bit my tongue nearly in half. Like it was a horrific.
This was in the seizures
this
coming
was in
down.
The seizures from, coming down. Yeah, it was a horrific experience, but it shook me to the core. And it was like I was looking at the world through a different lens. So when I went to detox, I became obsessed about the human mind. You could say I nearly switched addictions in a way. It's not really addiction. It was more an obsession and a drive in not a very balanced way, but it really helped me in that moment. So I was studying, I was learning, and that's what brought me off in a different direction. I actually forgot the original question. It was
about the family group therapy, because they came in, didn't they? Your parents had to come in.
So
nearly every week, I think. What was those discussions?
I was like, so the shift in perspective I had this zest and this really just energy for life, but I was still, because I was numbing myself for 15 plus years, I was still sort of numbed to negative emotions. So while they were all feeling the intensity of it all, they were coming in and I was sort of still numbed out to negative emotions. I was sort of leaning towards positive emotions. That was grand, energised. But my mum couldn't speak. She was just trying to speak and she'd cry. It was really, really difficult, but I wasn't feeling it. And to be quite honest, it's funny, we started the conversation with the book I wrote in 2020. It was only when I was writing the book in 2020 and I started talking to my mum, started talking to my sister, I really felt the depth of it. And I remember there was a week where I had a deadline, but I just couldn't write. I was really feeling the emotional impact of that. So recovery takes a long, long time, and it was nearly 5 years before I really start getting really in tune with my emotional world and allowing that sort of pain to come into my life, which I had to go through as well.
Do you remember those family sessions?
Vividly, because it was like that, as Brian explained there, like it was quite intense for us as a family, but Brian was quite enjoying it. He was enjoying the process and this new lease of life and, where he was. And you're in a bubble in a treatment centre as well. Like you're very much protected. So we were kind of like that, as I said, living on the outside world and there's so much going on. So it was definitely way more intense for us, I find.
Who's in the room, by the way, for these sessions?
The group therapy sessions was the families, all the concerned people and family members of...
But three or four, they'd start to take three or four clients and then their families. So there'd be about 15.
So there'd be other families
about
15
as well.
Yeah. It's a very intense environment, isn't it? But it's absolutely vital.
Yeah, it's great for people like that, for family members, because I found it like older people are going through this as well, like, you know, and they'd similar concerns and similar worries about their loved ones. So I did find that really therapeutic and quite valuable towards the process of healing and to kind of get to where we are now.
It was probably more valuable for the family. Like one thing I've really recognised, and even in this documentary I've learned more, because we were talking to some of the world's experts. Dr. Gabor Maté is in it, Dr. Anna Lemke is in it, we've had some fantastic people in it, and I learned so much. But there's different entry points into addiction, and recovery is the same. Recovery works for different people. I think that shift in perspective done it for me, and we can... Like, I think the anxiety that the family had at the time was they thought I was going to go back out and use. Yeah. They didn't know where my mind really was. So
instead, you're writing letters saying, I know how to fix your life. steady on. and can I ask, you've given up alcohol recently as well?
The past 2 years now, yes. It'll be two years.
But not because of addiction?
No, well, I didn't do a 12-step program. I didn't go into a recovery treatment centre, but definitely problematic use. So like would binge drink, would kind of use drink as a crutch, you know, for something negative happening, for something positive happening, because it's Tuesday, you know. So yeah, it was definitely, it would have been problematic. And it was causing issues in my own life where I wasn't living the life that I wanted to live. So I had this constant kind of undercurrent of anxiety and depression.
So because quietly nursing it with drink, essentially.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. And like we all drank, you know, from growing up, and like, you know, we would have I was celebrated with alcohol, like as most Irish families would. Yeah. But I definitely found that I was constantly thinking about, when can I have the next drink? You know, so that's where I found was the issue. So I wasn't able to be present and enjoy kind of everyday life and enjoy my kids, because I was constantly, you know, kind of like, when's the next kind of drink coming, or when can I have the next night out, or when can... And it was causing issue then as well with...
But you're 2 years now.
Over 2 years now, yeah. It's actually, it's such a flying, and it's great though. I wouldn't look, don't look back. And like Brian said, it was kind of like that light bulb moment. I was working towards it for so long, and then I got that moment where it just all connected, and I was like, right, I'm done. I've had enough.
And life, Brian Penny, for you is very good.
Life today is fantastic. Like, it really is. Like, I moved into a house with my partner last year. I fell in love for the first time 5 years ago, and I found recovery. Like, things are great.
That's Natalie.
Yeah.
This is your first serious kind of
relationship. Yeah, we met while I was writing the book. Actually, funny enough, and I knew nothing about her when we were chatting, and she was secretly reading my book. She knew everything about me. Yeah, but we have a fabulous life today. Like, I'm over in London next week working. Like, lots of great things going on. And this documentary. So it's, but more importantly, I think life's about connection with other human beings. We're emotional and social beings, and the family dynamic today in our family is just amazing. Like, we go hiking together.
You work together, don't you?
We work together as well. Yeah.
You're trained to be a psychotherapist.
At the moment. Yeah, I'm heading to college now after this.
Thanks a million for giving us the time. Most from this documentary is just that sense of hope that the two of you kind of embody today. You drifted apart, but you're the best of pals again.
And it is, like, as hard as that might seem, like, there's definitely, like, I wouldn't have believed when we were in it. I wouldn't have believed, like, I thought Brian was going to die. I was like, we buried our nan in March of 2013, and you got sober October 2013.
Yeah.
But I think if he didn't, he would have died. We would have been burying him next. So it's to go from that to, like, where we are today is kind of,
And there's always hope, like, and it can look so challenging for some families, but there is always hope.
Always.
Supports are available on rt.ie/helplines. And more help, of course, is just simply tuning in to Hooked. 3-part documentary series begins tomorrow, RT One Television. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, after the 9 o'clock news. Brian Penny and Anne, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.